Working as a newspaper reporter, covering some of the world's most intense conflicts and atrocities, could easily turn you into a cynic. Nicholas Kristof is with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his 40 years of experiences and life lessons reporting for the New York Times, and the people that saved his neck as he sought to report the truth to the outside world. His memoir is called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You know, Nick, you wrote about the frustration from a reporter who's gone to great lengths to get this information. When you bring the story home, it gets people all excited about that particular instance and wanting to help that particular person, but not really tuned into the larger problem, which is really the purpose of the journalism to start with.
Yeah, this came up all the time. I would be writing about, say, starvation in some hunger crisis, and I would choose as my subject to put a human face on it. One particular family, and the mom is trying to figure out whether to feed this child or that child. And then I would get a torrent of letters from people all wanting to know how they can send money to that one family. And from my point of view, it's great that this one family will get support, but I want to solve problems more structurally. That doesn't come from helping just one family. And so over time, I increasingly tried to figure out ways of working with aid groups or others so that people would channel their support for a larger population, not just one really lucky family.
Yeah, it's sort of a human nature to want to help that one person who's been humanized. We can identify with that person. And I always think there's sort of levels of sophistication in somebody's philanthropy. I mean, some people need a photograph of that particular person they're putting through school in Somalia on their mantle, which is a great thing. But I think when you think more about it, if you can impact policies, trade policies, or empower an NGO that's doing good work to give a whole society a chance to work and get ahead, that's going to accomplish a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think, as you say, that we're motivated by individual stories. And so I certainly have nothing against the aid groups that do try to connect people one by one, because I think that does bring out donors who otherwise wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
But, you know, education in particular is just such a cheap intervention. It's something that we kind of know how to do, and it is just so transformative. And it's one that has really worked. You know, when we were kids, Rick, a majority of human beings had always been illiterate, and there was a huge male-female gap in literacy. Mm-hmm. Today, we're pushing 90% adult literacy, and the gender gap is declining, is much, much lower.
I want to talk a little bit about journalism itself in your work, Nick. It seems to me this is kind of a look back on 40 years of work with the New York Times, and it's divided into two halves, isn't it, Nick? The first half was a foreign correspondent, and then more recently, opinion columnist?
Yeah, that's fair.
How are those two different? Just give us a kind of an understanding of the two jobs.
Well, so as a foreign correspondent, I was stationed abroad in China, in Japan, in Hong Kong, and I was traveling, you know, all the time. And I wasn't trying to tell people what to think. I was just covering issues. And then as a columnist, I've been stationed in the U.S., although traveling a great deal. I've been building my columns around opinions and making arguments. I should say that I think that's a little less true in my case than in the case of most correspondents and columnists. And, you know, when I was covering China in the aftermath of the Tiananmen democracy movement, I think readers kind of figured out that I disapproved of massacring student protesters.
Yeah.
And when I was writing about the Darfur genocide as a columnist, the interesting thing about what I wrote was not the opinion that genocide is bad. It was the reporting about the fact of the genocide itself.
Can you be a foreign correspondent without being an agenda journalist if you have a big heart?
Yeah, I think one can. And, you know, in truth, Rick, I don't think that our opinions really change people's minds very much on issues that they've thought about. I think that our foremost power as journalists, whether as correspondents or as columnists, is really the ability to project an issue that has been neglected, project that onto the agenda and make people think about it and talk about it. And I always try to make people spill their coffee in the morning, and on the theory that then if they spilled their coffee, they would take some action, they would reach out to the member of Congress.
Right.
And, you know, I saw change.
That's a great motivator for all the hard work you do. So we need that fourth estate to tell us the truth of what's going on in our democracy so we can be better citizens.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, the Fourth Estate is going to be a bit of a referee in the debate. And, you know, look, we in journalism, we screw up all the time. We mess up facts. We do all kinds of things wrong. But we're, you know, like all referees, but it's so much better having us in the field than having nothing.
But if you look at how that applies to today, I mean, when you look at a rally with Trump, he's looking to the back row and he's saying, there's the journalist. They're the problem.
Yeah.
What's he trying to do? Because he's got a playbook.
He's trying to intimidate the refs and or drive out the refs or discredit the refs. And he's doing that to journalists, but also to judges, to lawyers, to the other traditional referees. You know, we think of ourselves as a nation of laws, and we are. But a lot of what keeps America going is guardrails that are really more about norms than about laws and expectations. And I think he's trying to discredit those and undermine those norms and the referees. And he put a lot of pressure on journalists, and journalists originally didn't really know what to do. And I think we totally screwed up in 2016 when he first ran. I think we covered him the way we covered other candidates. And I don't think we conveyed to the public what we knew, which was that he lied to a degree that no other political candidate has in my lifetime in America. And I think we failed the American public.
Nicholas Kristof's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. In his memoir, Chasing Hope, Nick reveals why he's an optimist, despite all he's seen in his work reporting from the world's hotspots. Nick's joining us from his family farm in Oregon's Willamette Valley, where he started out as editor of his high school newspaper. Today, you'll see his op-ed columns twice a week in the New York Times. You can find out more about Nick's family farm, where they make cider and wine, at kristoffarms.com. You know, in our lifetimes, Nick, I think there's been a fundamental change in journalism in the fact that it's gone from kind of news to entertainment. I mean, when Walter Cronkite said, "That's the way it is," I mean, that really was the way it was, because the network did not want to make money during the news hour, right? That was their contribution to our democracy, was not to have, if it bleeds, it leads journalism, if they could avoid it, just to get more money on their advertising.
I think part of it was that news organizations, certainly newspapers, had to some degree monopolies locally, and they also had a certain sense of responsibility to the public. And they had a great business model. And then that just kind of fell apart with the internet. And it is continuing to fall apart. It is, you know, done enormous damage to newspapers. But I think cable television is under threat. You know, broadcast radio is under threat, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody is scrambling for audience at a time when they kind of know what the audience is looking after.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a lot harder to convince a news organization to go off and cover the war in Congo, which is the most lethal conflict since World War II, rather than, you know, put a celebrity in the studio and interview him or her.
A few years ago, I read a book by Mort Rosenblum called Escaping Plato's Cave, and he was lamenting how they were not employing foreign correspondents as much anymore. And that was 15 years ago. And you talk about that, too, in your book, how journalism on the cheap really... we take a big hit in the value of journalism when we can't pay foreign correspondents to get out there and be on the spot.
And it's really hard, because the underlying issue is that audiences are less interested in it. There was a period there when I was covering Iraq where every trip from the Baghdad airport to downtown Baghdad to the New York Times Bureau, every trip cost $10,000 because of security to keep you alive in that 45-minute journey. And the New York Times was willing to pay that, and so we covered Iraq. But, you know, a lot of other organizations just could not afford that, especially at a time when there was less interest in Iraq.
You know, this relates to a quote that you shared in your book, Chasing Hope, from Elie Wiesel. And if I got it right, Wiesel said, "What hurts a victim the most is not the brutality of the oppressor, but the silence of the bystander." It seems that that motivates you in your work a little bit, and it must motivate a lot of foreign correspondents.
Absolutely. You know, we have a spotlight, and so we can go places and shine a light on places, on people. Imperfectly raises the cost to the oppressor, of genocide or mass atrocities, it brings a little more attention, a little more aid to those people, and it does help. And I've seen that in the case of the Darfur genocide 20 years ago in Sudan. There were hundreds of thousands of people who were killed. And, you know, that was so frustrating when I was covering that. But there are also hundreds of thousands of people who are alive today because of news coverage, because of the works of nonprofits, of churches and synagogues and mosques to try to raise attention to the crisis. And so imperfectly, it really does make a difference when we get that attention.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're learning from Nicholas Kristof about the value of foreign correspondence and good journalism. His book is Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Nick, it's so interesting to think about the value of the travel moments you've had and how that translates into powerful and important journalism. A few things that I've noticed when I've been traveling in the developing world is when I was in Ethiopia, somebody mentioned you've got road bias because I was staying on the paved road. And I noticed in your book that you go to great lengths to get off the grid and then get off the grid and then spot check statistics. Find a child in a land that's supposed to have good education and say, what's 4 plus 8? And see if they really know how to add. Have you thought much about the problem of road bias and how you have to make a point to get away from that?
I have, you know, partly because I grew up in and I'm, you know, now speaking to you from a place that is off the road from my family farm in rural Oregon. You know, I don't think that people in Washington necessarily know a great deal about what is happening in towns, little hamlets like mine. So when I go off to a place like Ethiopia, I'm also a little bit skeptical about how much English speakers in the capital are going to know about what is going on in rural Ethiopia.
That was one of my big concerns during the Sandinista Contra time is I felt that powerful people from our country were going down and meeting with people on the rooftop garden of the Intercontinental Hotel,
yep.
And they weren't getting out in the barrio. And it occurred to
totally.
Me, you know, a travel writer is like a medieval jester. You know, he gets out there and he hangs out with the people in the barrios and he knows what the jokes are against the king and so on. And then he goes back behind the walls of the fortress and he can tell the king to his face what the people are really thinking. And in a sense,
I think it's exactly right.
You're a medieval jester. you're bringing home the truth and annoying the people in power.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting when we travel that we encounter things we'd never encounter at home? I always think that you learn a lot about your own reality on this planet by leaving home and looking at it from a distance. We take so much for granted, like our democracy, or when you travel in the developing world, I'm always impressed. You see a lot of jerry cans. I never even thought of jerry cans before. Do you know what I mean about that?
Yeah, the importance of power. And I used to look down a little bit on the aspirations for democracy from peasants in various places and thought, they don't really know what democracy is. And then at Tiananmen Square in 1989, I saw peasants, rickshaw drivers who were risking their lives for that democracy that maybe they couldn't define, but they cared about so passionately. And I wish that in this country, we had a little bit more of that passion to sustain the democracy that we already have.
Nicholas Kristof has won Pulitzer Prizes for his columns on Darfur and for his coverage of China, reporting with his wife, Cheryl Wudun. They've also written 5 books together. Nick's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his career as a reporter and foreign correspondent, which he outlines in his latest book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You'll find links to his work in the notes for this week's show. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Nicholas, as I was reading through the book, I kept thinking, for you, there must be examples of where you're really proud of our country, America, and also where you're ashamed of our country. Can you give me an example from your reporting? What comes to mind when you think of how you're proud of our nation and how there are cases where you're just not very proud of it?
The one where I'm, you know, where I'm really proud of it was our response to AIDS. When I began to cover AIDS around the world, it just loomed, especially over Southern Africa, as this sword of Damocles, and it was destroying societies. And then the U.S., under President George W. Bush, started a program called PEPFAR that was transformative for these countries. And I first understood the degree to which it was transformative when I visited in Malawi and Lesotho. I talked to undertakers and they were coffin makers and they were saying that, you know, the coffin making business was collapsing because people weren't dying anymore because of PEPFAR. And it had saved 25 million lives. This is something that we should truly be proud of. And then I think in terms of things that I'm not proud of, I think that we've so often reached for weapons, and because we have a great army, that we tend to think that the solution to problems is going to involve guns. And sometimes that's true. And I think we need a strong military. But I think, in my lifetime, whether it's in Vietnam or Iraq in particular, I think we were much too quick to reach for weaponry in ways that did not advance our own interests and were devastating to civilians.
You know, on the cover of your book, I kind of expected to see a photograph of you with a helmet on, ducking for cover in some broken state. But you are clearly the face, the happiness on your face and your arms outstretched, surrounded by the great nature of the Pacific Crest Trail. And it's a shot of you as you were hiking from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada and having a great time with your daughter. What a very interesting stage in your life you're in now, growing apples and grapes with your children on a farm in Oregon and hiking the Pacific Crest Trail.
I mean, it's a wonderful thing about the world today that I can be a New York Times columnist and write books and be on the family farm and produce, first-rate wine and cider. And it's a great learning experience. I as a liberal columnist, I rarely meet a regulation I don't like. And as a small business owner, I'm periodically outraged by this or that regulation.
That's great.
And it's a good instinct to discover. It's a good thing to discover.
And I'm curious about this. You've spent a career watching over other actors and assessing their deeds. And the last words in your book, in some sort of acknowledgement at the very end, you say, "You're with your children on a farm in Oregon while being watched by elk, bear, and eagles." So is that tied into you being an oversight and now they've got oversight?
I must say that I have oversight over the bears and cougars and elk as well. But it just, in writing the book, Rick, I actually kind of self-diagnosed myself with a certain amount of PTSD from covering war and genocide. And I think I self-prescribed myself a certain amount of wilderness therapy, and that is behind perhaps my hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail, and also I think by my love for the farm and this beautiful spot and the wildlife here.
I think a lot of us can be inspired by that, and we can go out and boldly better understand the world by grappling with it, and we can come home, I think, knowing all in all the world's a good place. It's filled with love. It's filled with joy. And we have a lot to be thankful for and a lot to take care of.
Oh, we sure do. We sure do. If you wanted to choose one time in the history of humanity, you would probably want to choose this time. Mm-hmm. And, you could do a lot worse than choosing, well, from my point of view, the Pacific Northwest.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you so much for joining us and best wishes with your work. And thanks for writing Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life.
Great to be with you, Rick.
We're heading for Paris next as we check in with a local author who's dedicated himself to finding the very best bistros, bakeries, cheese shops, department store food halls, and kitchen supply shops in the world's most delicious city. It's Travel with Rick Steves.